You're listening to a podcast from the South China Morning Post.
Hello and welcome to the US-China Trade War Podcast. I'm Finbar Birmingham on the Political Economy Desk here at the South China Morning Post. What a week we've had in Hong Kong. We have seen China's parliamentary body approve the national security laws for Hong Kong, which brought a strong rebuke from the United States, which says it will no longer recognize the city's autonomy. What does that mean for the trade war? We'll hear more on that later this week when Trump announces what actions he will take, but it has certainly helped blast the rivalry up a notch or two. You will hear from our political economy editors John Carter and Zhou Xin presenting their views as to what this means for Hong Kong, what this means for the US-China rivalry, and whether this is another battle with China that Washington will be fighting alone. Talking of fighting with China, a nascent trade dispute has sprung up over recent weeks with Australia, the most China-reliant trading nation on earth, feeling the force of tariffs and export bans on barley and beef. Su Lin Tan from the Political Economy Reporting Team has been following the story closely, and she will give us the skinny on that. Enjoy the show. A new chapter in the US-China rivalry on an old battleground, but a severe escalation this week. On Thursday, our time, before China's National People's Congress had approved the national security law for Hong Kong, US Secretary of State Mike Pompeo told Congress that Hong Kong was no longer considered autonomous from China. This is an assessment that could threaten the city's long-standing special trading status. We're expecting something from US President Donald Trump by the end of the week. We're recording on Friday morning, and I'm here with John Carter and Zhou Xin to get some analysis on what this means for the US-China rivalry. First of all, Zhou Xin, how was this news greeted in Beijing, where all of the political luminaries around the country had gathered for the annual policy-setting meeting?
Pompeo's speech didn't really get even discussed or talked publicly in Beijing. And at yesterday's press conference by Premier Li Keqiang, he sent out a very reconciliatory tone, saying, you know, US-China should be work together. You know, there's still room for cooperation, especially in trade and business. So he was not really addressing the Hong Kong issue. And to be frank, I think Pompeo's comments that China, Hong Kong is no longer autonomous from China, I think it's a little bit exaggeration. First of all, the law has been, we haven't seen the details of the law, and implementation will be another issue. And Hong Kong still has great autonomy in terms of financial trade system, even its governance. You know, if we look at Hong Kong today, for anyone who visits Hong Kong, you still feel, even for tourists, you feel like it's different from mainland China, so it's a little bit unfair to say that it's no longer autonomous. And of course, there are lots of talk about Hong Kong in China, mainly about this national security law. You know, Hong Kong is still very important for China as a whole. Hong Kong has been playing a very important role for China's economic development. Hong Kong remains a gateway for capital flow into China, and China really want to maintain that. China really want to keep Hong Kong's special role of that gateway. You know, when the UN wants to get international, Hong Kong is the first to stop. And when people want to invest money into China, Hong Kong is still the ideal place to place most of their money. But this the protest and the social unrest the last year has really changed the mindset in Beijing somehow. Hong Kong remains very, very, very important. Hong Kong cannot be replaced by Shenzhen or Shanghai in the next 5 to 10 years, or even a longer period of time. But compared to 1997, the role has been diminished in terms of both trade and investment.
I'll turn to you in a second, John. But Julian, I just wanted to ask you one more on that, because this is something they must have known that the United States would react strongly to this, given all the political rivalry that's been growing. So will they have calculated in the risk, factored in the risk of, Trump perhaps removing Hong Kong's special status further down the line of, sanctioning individuals, of, these sorts of punitive actions? This has been factored in, but China still thinks that the risk is big enough to it's important enough to take.
I don't have any inside information, but I'm sure that's the trade-off, the consideration the consideration for Beijing is to balance. On one hand, Hong Kong is a financial center. Hong Kong has played an important role in China's trade and opening up. On the other hand, there is a significant national security risk. And so for now, I think the concern about national security risk has outweighed the potential cost or potential undermining of the Hong Kong's financial role. So that's why the national security law was such a big thing in China, because and also from the opposite point of view, the fact that China is promoting the national security law in such a high profile manner also showcased that there, before the law was made, there must be some debates or even very different opinions within the policy-making circle. And that's why they need to take this chance to unify, to put everyone on the same page.
John, the other parts of the world have issued, other governments around the world rather, have issued quite strong statements condemning this. The UK came out along with Canada, Australia and the US to make a statement saying it was an erosion of the one country, two systems model under which Hong Kong is governed. Japan disapproved. South Korea said it was monitoring it closely. But as yet, nobody has actually confirmed or even intimated that they would be willing to take this sort of we haven't seen the US action, but presume punitive action that the United States will choose, because they're, as one government told us yesterday, not keen to touch a raw nerve in Beijing. Is there a sense again that the US will be fighting this alone?
Very much. Very much. It's the US first and the US alone is the theme, and Trump has done this before. You look at Iran, for instance. He's willing to go it alone if he feels strongly about it, and I think that he will do that again this time. And as you say, other countries will protest. They will use strong language. Japan called in the Chinese ambassador to demand an explanation. So it clearly has created waves on the diplomatic front, but in terms of actually taking the next step and implementing sanctions of some kind, I don't see any other country at this point doing anything other than the United States. Mm-hmm. There's just, and this is, as you touched on earlier, this is part of Beijing's calculations, is that there would be loud protests, but no action, except from the United States, and the growing feeling in Beijing, which I think Joshin can confirm, that the relations on are a rapidly downward path, and there's nothing they can do about it. And so they might as well get on with what they think they need to do in order to keep control of their sphere of influence, which includes, of course, Hong Kong.
Yeah.
Over the longer run, we'll have to see how this plays out. Implementation of the law is critical. The business people we talk to here in Hong Kong don't like the new law. They acknowledge that the protests have hurt business and they want the violence to stop, but they're concerned about this new law for several reasons, in part because it circumvents the local parliament. It's just being imposed by Beijing. So the idea that the Hong Kong still governs itself is not as true as it was before. They will see how the law plays out. In the short run, they have no choice. There are very few options. They want to do business in Hong Kong because it's the gateway to China. The rule of law here, the stable exchange rate, are all big advantages for doing business here. And as we've already reported, about 70% of the direct investment into mainland China flows through Hong Kong. So it's a big, important financial center for China. The question is, in the short run, there's no option. But in the longer run, will firms choose other paths, either dealing with China directly or relocating their operations and investing elsewhere? That is the big question. Nobody knows. Again, that depends critically on how the law is implemented, how strictly it's enforced.
We'll see later on today, I think, Donald Trump's supposed to give a press conference on sometime Friday, his time. But conversations I was having this week with people in Washington connected with White House, not as optimistic even as they were last week or the week before about the prospects of phase one trade deal. It's fair to say that people didn't expect the relationship to so rapidly deteriorate. I think everybody recognized the trajectory, but nobody expected it to deteriorate so quickly. Turning to Joe Shin again, Hong Kong's special status is at risk. We'll maybe learn more about that later when President Trump speaks. You've already said that it's very important to Hong Kong. Hong Kong's very important to China. What does this move say? John's already alluded to maybe that the deteriorating relationship with the US was already in the calculus. But does this show that for China, it's more keen to exert control over all of its regions than it is to preserve that strong economic front?
Well, Fingba, I think regarding the, I'm not an expert in law, but I think regarding the national security law for Hong Kong, there are several outstanding misceptions. The first one is that it is completely out of the blue, you know, because the outside world didn't see this coming doesn't mean Beijing hasn't been preparing for several months. And actually, in the last fall, in the 40th plenum of the 19th Party Congress, Xi Jinping has already set one key sentence, that is to having this legal framework and implementation system in Hong Kong regarding national security. And that's already a very clear signal that, you know, a group of people or even hundreds of people are already trying to articulate his idea into this national security law. And then the second one is also, so this is not something overnight. This is a process. And in this process, if we're looking back in the past few months, we can see that China, on the other hand, is still negotiating this phase one trade deal with Trump, you know, still is trying to manage the China-US relationship, you know, from a too quick deterioration. And the second misperception is that China's move, the national security law in Hong Kong, is just the first step of the many things that Beijing will come after immediately. This is also not right, because I don't think Beijing is really in a hurry to end Hong Kong's autonomy. As I just said, China, the law is to address national security threats from Beijing's perspective. It's not to try to end Hong Kong's role as a financial gateway for Beijing or end Hong Kong's special role for China.
China's booming economy. I'm going to use that as a segue to John for the week ahead, because on Sunday, what's happening?
The official Purchasing Managers Index will be released. This is a sentiment indicator. They talk to businesses and they ask them how their business is doing. It has been, it was extremely low in February and March and rebounded in April. Manufacturing is expanding, the activity is expanding, but at a very low rate. The service sector has been stable, but not increasing much. The big increase has been in the construction sector because of infrastructure spending. So we'll see what goes on in this latest reading for the month of May. We have other indicators that suggest that activity has plateaued. The recovery in activity since the trough in February and March had been improving, and now it has stopped improving. It's about somewhere between 80 and 90% of pre-virus capacity. Which means that a number of businesses haven't reopened, and a number of businesses are operating below capacity.
Yeah, I think the Trivium Index is, if that's the one you're referring to, I think the main point that I took away from it is that 99% of businesses are open, but it's the actual getting back up to full speed that's the issue.
Yes, certainly 99% of an industrial business is less so for service firms, but. And we're starting to see the indications that the reduction in demand from the U.S. and Europe is starting to hit Chinese businesses because of what the pandemic is doing to those countries now. And so we'll see what that shows and what the outlook for the Chinese economy is on Sunday.
Absolutely. John Carter, Joe Shin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
This is the US-China Trade War podcast, of course, but over recent weeks, we've seen a new trade dispute emerge down under. China and Australia have come to loggerheads over what has been a long-standing trade spat, a number of issues there. But in the last few weeks, it's really grown arms and legs. And I'm joined by Sulin Tan, who is a reporter on our political economy desk, who has been covering this issue in great depth to find out more about what's going on. Sulin, I know that the issues of barley and beef are long-standing, but just for the listeners who may not be familiar with the details of this, give us a really brief explanation as to what's happened over recent weeks.
Right. So China's imposed a tariff on barley. Australia and China had a free trade agreement. It's zero tariff on barley. Now, since November 2018, there's been a dispute about barley. So Australia's been dumping barley or cheaper barley in China, cheaper than Australia's prices. So China's instigated that an investigation saying that the cheap barley actually hurts its domestic economy. So that's been ongoing since November 2018. It takes about 18 months to get that investigation through. And it did flag that the final report would come through in May, which is, you know, this month. Mm-hmm. So the timing of all that, you know, that stretches off quite a while. So that's the history. On beef, there was also a suspension of exports from four abattoirs. These four abattoirs belong to three meat processing companies, and they too have had some issues with processing the beef previously, and they've had sanctions on their exports as well. That was in 2017, and they've made the same mislabeling and certificate errors again in the last 14 months, and so China slapped on another sanction on their exports.
Yeah, so these are two important industries in Australia. China, Australia's biggest trading partner, and running into difficulty at a time of economic trouble in both China and Australia. As Sulin has illustrated very well there, these are long-running trade disputes. It's not really necessarily anything new, but you've also intimated that the timing is quite interesting. There are political dimensions to this as well, Sulin.
Yeah, it does raise eyebrows, definitely in Australia. I mean, you know, you've got all the trade industry groups getting quite concerned that it all started because our Prime Minister decided he wanted to coordinate the international inquiry into the coronavirus after a little call with US President Trump. So now it sounds like China's retaliating against Australia for actually wanting to lead the charge investigating the coronavirus.
Yeah. And these aren't like things that happen quite commonly with China, that it has legitimate trade grievances with its trading partners, and often they come to light or they come to fruition at a point of political difference. So it's often different to see where one ends and the other one begins. But Sulin, your reporting has been great on this, and you've been speaking to a lot of people involved in these industries, in the beef sector and in the barley sector. We know that Australia is heavily reliant on China buying its goods to support the economy. So what are people in those sectors saying? Are they very worried about this going further?
I think there are, I mean, certainly Australia is the most China-dependent economy in the world. 32% of its exports go to China. So there is legitimate concerns to be worried. For example, you see that the beef producers, they're quite concerned. A lot of their premium beef go to China. That's where the biggest demand comes from. So on that front, yes, they're very concerned. The barley farmers are very concerned. You know, 80% of their exports go there. And, you know, where would they find an alternative market that would soak up all the barley?
There isn't one.
They're exactly right. Yeah. So on that front, yes, there's a lot of concerns. But I think what Australia is trying to do right now is to try and diversify its sources really quickly and try and find new people to take up, new groups, new countries to take up these exports. But it's not going to replace China, definitely.
No. An interesting point that we were reporting early on in this is the timing with regard to coronavirus and that investigation was interesting. But another element of the timing was also quite questionable. So in the week that China put an 80.5% tariff on Australian barley, it opened the door for American barley as part of the Phase One trade deal, which we've discussed at length on this podcast before. But I mean, again, these are the machinations of international trade that sometimes go on behind closed doors. But that's another quite fortunate or fortuitous element to this story, Su Lin.
Yeah, there is discussion on that, but also, you know, conversation discourse out of the US says, no, I mean, it's two separate matters and they're not one and the same. And it's not as if, you know, you replace one market. It's not a zero-sum game. You know, they're two separate relationships, definitely. And also, one thing to make note of is China's not going to be able to import, for example, barley. US is not a big producer as Australia. So it's not going to be able to replace Australia. And, you know, a bigger market, for example, would be Canada. But Canada and China are not in a trade war. It's US. So it's not you know, apples and apples. You don't replace one and put US in place of Australia.
Not in this case, sure. Although with Canada, you mentioned there, and this is an example that I've often thought about in this Australian situation. It reminds me of when China banned canola from Canada last year, which was, again, under certain trade grounds, they found some sort of pest in the crop or something. But it just so happened to be around the time that this extradition case on Meng Wanzhou, the Huawei executive. So again, you can put two and two together and make five here. But again, a lot of the similar conversation that we're having now was taking place this time last year as well with regard to this. Is there a sense that there have been some statements trying to cool things down from the Australian side? They were quite clear that they don't want to be involved in a trade war with China. What's the latest on that?
I think there's two camps in there. There's a group that says, oh, look, we'll stand up, Australia can stand up to China, and China's a bully, and, we should hold our own. And then there are other groups that are saying, what's the point of all that? Mm. I mean, it's not about standing up against a bully. It's about diplomatic relations. And it is trying to make sure that those relationships are looked after. And, China works in different ways, and so does Australia. They're two different cultures, and there's a discussion right now that, it's important for all the diplomats to get together and talk quietly about it rather than, go to blows in the open sort of media channels. And it just doesn't seem very diplomatic in that sense.
Sure.
So I think it's softening in Australia. There is certainly a media beat up about it being a war of sorts. But I think perhaps there's a bit of a step back.
Yeah, it hasn't gone unnoticed in the US. I was reading the transcript of a statement by the Deputy Secretary for East Asia, David Stillman, last night. And yeah, he alluded to the Australian situation with beef, barley. He mentioned wine and other imports as well. But it's interesting that in a statement which was ostensibly about the Hong Kong security law and the US retaliation to that, unprompted, the US senior official alluded to Australia. So certainly something that's not going unnoticed over there.
Yes, yeah, certainly. I think many people see Australia somewhat as a bit of a proxy for what will happen to those who cross, China's path. That China has the ability to use economic coercion to extract what it wants, of course. But it's yet to be seen. I mean, I think you can see China's developing all sorts of, new art of war strategy in this game, if you want to call it. And you can say, oh, look, it is forming a new pattern for China, but we don't really know. I mean, for example, these issues with barley and beef, China could have gone to the AWTO many, many times over to complain about this like all the other countries do, but it hasn't. Maybe it's storing up for, using it as a tool for later retaliation. We don't know. But this is one example with Australia. Maybe there's more to be seen before we form an opinion on that.
And I know that you're on top of that. You've got a spreadsheet, which I've had a glimpse of all these products, which might be next. And I'm sure we'll have you back on the podcast to talk about it soon. Su Lin Tan, thank you so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to the US-China Trade War podcast with Finbar Birmingham of the political economy team here at the SCMP. Donald Trump's probably going to make a big announcement about this over the weekend. We'll see what US action will be taken against China over Hong Kong. You can read all about that at scmp.com. You can follow us on Twitter at SCMP Economy. I'm at F Birmingham. That's Birmingham with a B-E-R, not like the city. And we'll see you back here next week.
For more podcasts from the South China Morning Post, head to scmp.com, where you can hear more about technology, trade, culture, and society.